All right, today we get what I guess is my favorite legal system, the one that got me into this sort of silliness. But before I start talking about that, let me start with comments and questions from you from reading my Icelandic. Yes?
So, I hesitate to ask this. Would you mind explaining Coase's theorem?
Sure.
It's kind of essential.
I'm not sure it's essential, but I'll be happy to explain. We start... The real problem is that the Coase theorem is a little snippet in the middle of a much longer analysis. And one of the problems with the term Coase theorem is it's an easy term to remember, and therefore people think they understand what Coase was doing without having to actually go to the work of understanding. But let me at least attempt. And if you want a longer version, you will find an article on my webpage on the part of it that's got all my articles on it. It may be called The Swedes Get It Right, but it was... I think I did versions of that with a couple of titles, but it's an article about ghostly ideas. We start with the problem of externalities. All right, the problem is... Go back one step. We start with the coordination problem. You've got huge numbers of people who have to somehow coordinate their activities to get anything done. And the simple decentralized solution to that is a system of private property and trade, which the first approximation has the feature that each person bears the costs that he imposes and receives the benefits he creates. So if I work to build something and I sell it to whoever values it most, the value of producing that thing is the value to whoever values it most, and I get that reward when I sell it. In order to produce it, I've got to use various inputs. I have to pay enough for those inputs to bid them away from whoever else would use them. So therefore, the cost to other people of not having them is the price that I pay. Right? If you would have paid $1 for an apple, I offer $1.01 to get the apple to make applesauce. The cost to you, in effect, ignoring the flows of money, the social cost, as it were, is that you lose $1 worth of apple, that goes into the price of my apple, goes into the price of my applesauce. That's sort of the very, very simple version of price theory. And if that was all there was, then you would automatically get an economically efficient outcome with no work at all. And one of the problems is that there exist externalities, in the sense there exist cases in which either some of the benefit or some of the benefit I produce goes to other people in a way in which I can't capture it, or some of the costs I impose goes to other people in a way in which it's not practical for them to charge anything for it. So if producing steel requires the labor of steel workers, that's fine, because they'll only work for me if I pay them what they see as the value of their labor. But if it also produces air pollution, then I will ignore that cost in deciding how much steel to produce, and my steel will be underpriced. The price of the steel will reflect the cost of the other inputs, but not the cost of the externality. All
right. So was Coase the first guy to basically argue for the whole externality?
No. On the contrary, what Coase did was to show that the solution to this problem that the entire profession had accepted for 30 years was wrong. We come now to a man called Pigou. Pigou was an English economist who raised the point. The issue had been discussed before then. Pigou had a solution. And he had a very simple... The obvious wrong solution to the externality problem is to have some government agency that tells the steel mill, here's how much pollution you can put out, here's what controls you have to have, and so forth. And that's a centralized mechanism, and it's very hard to make that work for a complicated system, especially since the people who are giving those orders have their own axes to grind. Maybe they want campaign contributions from the steel mill, and so forth. Pigou's solution is price the externality. If my air pollution per ton of sulfur put in the air does $20 worth of damage, then have some system for measuring my pollution and bill me $20 every time I put a ton of sulfur in the air. Now, the steel mill will now make the right decision on producing steel just as it does without externalities. If the cost to me of preventing the pollution is more than the damage done, I won't prevent it. And in that case, the price of steel will go up to reflect the fact that one of the costs of producing steel is air pollution. That cost is now showing up in the price, so less steel will be produced, less air pollution will be produced, and steel will be produced only up to the point where the value of the people who use it is enough to make up for the cost.
And this doesn't work.
This doesn't work. This is the Pigouvian solution. It's a simple and elegant solution. Everybody believed it.
Yeah, you're right.
And
I still believe it.
No, you may still believe it.
At
some point around 1960, a little after that, Coase came to give a talk at the University of Chicago on his work. And there was a dinner at the house of Aaron Director, at which there were about 14 economists, of whom I think maybe four eventually got Nobel Prizes, counting Coase. And Coase explained his ideas. And at the beginning of that dinner, the argument was 13-1 against Coase. And at the end, it was 14-0 for Coase. That's the sort of one of the most famous anecdotes of economics, law and economics at University of Chicago. And Coase's argument was preceded in what I like to think of as three steps. And the first step is nothing works, the second step is everything works, and the third step is it all depends. And the nothing works is the rebuttal of Pigou. Because Coase says, let us imagine, take one, this isn't his example, but it'll do. Imagine we've got this steel mill producing pollution. And why does the pollution impose a cost? Because there are people living downwind from the steel mill who don't like breathing the sulfur air. There are, in fact, two solutions to this problem. One of them is to stop polluting, two ways to stop eliminating the cost. And the other is to use that land for something other than residential housing. And if the air pollution doesn't strike you as a good example, think about airports. All right. It is quite costly to hold down the noise of airplanes landing. One solution is to have something like a Coastal, like a Pigouvian tax, where you tell the airline you pay a fine proportion to the amount of noise you do, which measures the cost imposed on people under the flight path of what you're doing. And the other solution is to say you do not pay that cost. The people under the flight path bear the cost of the externality. And the result is that the land under the flight path gets used for growing grain, which isn't bothered by noise, rather than for suburban real estate. So the initial point is that everybody was thinking of an externality as a cost A imposes on B. Whereas really, externality is a cost which comes from decisions made both by A and by B. That one doesn't know a priori which of the two can at lower cost solve the problem. And the Pigouvian approach automatically picks one of them that it claims is providing the externality, says he bears the cost. If the result is that he then doesn't produce the externality, the other one has no incentive to change what he's doing. And therefore, in that case, the Pigouvian solution is the one. Is that? The airline case is probably a better one because it seems a lot more plausible to many of us that the right solution is to use the land for something else. Note that also means that the tort solutions, you can think of tort law as a version of the Pigouvian tax, where I impose a cost on you and then I've got to pay that amount. But the tort solution of the airline case means that the people underneath the flight path have no incentive to use the land for something else. They indeed have no incentive even to soundproof their houses unless the court pays attention to whether they have, because they're getting compensated for the inconvenience due to the noise. So the first step of Coase's argument is to say nothing works. Coase's second step is, well, actually everything works. And everything works because as long as we can ignore transaction costs, anytime you've got an inefficient outcome, an outcome where I'm preventing the problem at a cost of $5,000 but you can prevent it at a cost of $2,000, it will always pay me to go to you and to make a deal where I pay you something between $2,000 and $5,000, and you, for example, sell your urban real estate under the flight path to the airline company. The airline company then resells it to farmers with a license or a restriction that it can't be used for anything but farming. And if you think about that series of transactions, you can see that indeed the cost of shifting the use of the land is lower than the cost of soundproofing the airplanes, it will be profitable to make that transaction. So the second step of Coase's argument is to say, if you can ignore transaction costs, then as long as you define your property rights in some fashion, you will always get the efficient outcome due to bargaining between the parties. All right, that's the Coase theorem. The Coase theorem is, in a world of zero transaction costs, you get an efficient outcome as long as you define property rights however you define it. And then the third step is to say, well, what about those transaction costs? So think about the question of air pollution in Los Angeles. Suppose it seems very likely that the solution is not emptying Los Angeles, We're turning it into farmland. Some people in Northern California might think that a fine project. But the solution is to have people who drive produce less pollution. And imagine the property rights we start out with are ones which there are no restrictions on air pollution from automobiles. So it's sort of the obvious simple property right, which is let the damage lie where it falls. On that model, the Coasean solution, the Coase theorem solution, is a contract by which everybody who breathes in Los Angeles pays everybody who drives in Los Angeles to agree to reduce their air pollution. And you can see that the difficulties in organizing that contract are rather substantial. That from the standpoint of the people who are paying to start with, it's a public good in the sense that if 90% of people in Los Angeles agree to chip in, that'll do it, so why should I chip in? So you're going to have a hard problem getting people to pay for it, and then negotiating the contract with all the drivers. So the third step of Coase's argument is saying understanding why you get inefficient outcomes, you have to ask not merely why, where is there an externality, but why is this externality not bargained away by private transactions? So you then have to look at transaction costs. Now, if anybody wants, I can point you at longer versions of all of this available online from my webpage if people are curious. I think the Coase article, The Problem of Social Costs, may still be the most cited article in economics, law and economics. And I've got it in two places. There's an article on my webpage, which is, I think, called The Swedes Got It Right, but it's got some reference to Coase in it. That's because he got the Nobel Prize, which was surprisingly intelligent of the people giving it. And the other place is my book, Law's Order, is on my webpage, and I think about chapter 3, if I remember correctly, I explain the problem from the Bagubian standpoint, and I then go on to explain Coase, and I go through in agonizing detail how you would use the Coasean approach to decide on the right property rules in a single example. Coase, an example that Coase actually uses and discusses because Bagubian uses it, is a railroad train that's throwing sparks. These are 19th century railroad trains which start fires in the adjacent wheat fields. And the question is, you could imagine the train putting on a spark arrestor, an expensive thing that is supposed to catch the sparks. But you could also, as Coase would point out, if Bagubian doesn't, imagine the farmers growing clover in the land near the railroad line, because clover doesn't burn, and growing wheat somewhere else. And I go through the possible legal rules you could have and why one or another might be the efficient rule and how you would or wouldn't bargain for the efficient outcome from each starting point. So I have what I like to refer to as a spaghetti diagram, which says, given these four starting points and these four ending points, the ending points would actually happen when you grow clover or wheat, for example. Spark arrestor or no spark arrestor. The starting points are things like, is the railroad liable in tort for the damage from the fires? Here is how you get from each starting point to each ending point. Here are the transactional problems that will block it. This is, if you knew which ending point was most likely to be the efficient, you could, or how likely they are, you could figure it out. So it's sort of an exercise in, if only you had a bunch of information, which we don't really have, how you could rigorously deduce the law, which I think is project, even though it's only a way of understanding things, not an actual computer program that we can use to rewrite the law. Right. So, if you people are curious about this stuff, it's interesting and important stuff. It's relevant to this course only to the extent that it's relevant to all of law. But since you asked the question, that's my long digression. All right. Yes?
Just one quick question. Wasn't the point, though, or part of the point of the theorem that it doesn't matter where you design the right?
That would be the point of the theorem, but that is not what Coase is saying.
No, but isn't that its application, there are limited, view of law and economics that it was taught in torts. That's kind of how it came across to us, that it wouldn't really matter who you assign the right to, because they will find that.
That would be true only in a world of zero transaction.
Yeah, no, that's...
The term Coase theorem is not due to Coase.
Yeah.
It's probably due to George Stigler, who was a very witty man, and it's not clear whether it was a good idea or not, because it has the disadvantage that people can state the Coase theorem in a sentence and then think they understand what Coase was saying.
But you're saying, though, it's zero transaction costs and then equal knowledge on both sides, right?
I guess I would have thought of knowledge, things like knowledge asymmetries, as really being a transaction cost. Transaction costs aren't very well defined, but I think we have some feel for what they cover. But in any case, But the argument is much more sophisticated than that, because Coase obviously knew that transaction costs aren't always zero. So you analyze, you know, just like, you know, if you're working out Newtonian mechanics, it's often useful to do it in a vacuum. Nonetheless, Newtonian mechanics is used to help design airplanes, which don't fly in a vacuum. So the first step is to eliminate the complications. You work out your theory that way, and you can then go on from there. The other questions? Any questions on Iceland? Since that's yes.
I was wondering about this distinction between killing and murder, and
yes.
The fact that you could just—it was there. It was only a killing if you would declare that you had just done it. And I was wondering how they enforce how you keep track of that sort of thing. How you
there's this dead body lying here.
Right.
Unless he hit it becomes murder if you hide the body. Of course. There's a missing guy, and after a while, we find the dead body. And if we can figure out who did it, he did or didn't publicly announce to one of the near neighbors that he had done the killing.
And so, but then there's an almost endless list of hypotheticals that come to mind. Like, let's say you were hunting in the woods and your stray arrow killed someone. How do you declare that you've done that killing?
You find the nearest neighbor.
Okay.
And you say, sorry about that, but there's this fellow out there who I think it looks sort of like Helgi, and he's got my arrow in it, and it was really a careless mistake, and of course I will pay appropriate wear geld to his kinsman.
And the opposing side says something like, because you know, they happen to not like you for some reason. The opposing side says, well, but the distance you traveled is clearly more than three houses, therefore
well, except that it probably isn't. That is, you went to the nearest neighbor. The nearest neighbor may be 30 miles away. I mean, mm-hmm. Iceland was not very densely settled.
Oh, so
there are no towns in Iceland at this time.
So
zero.
Right past three houses, if you were really talking about miles and miles of distance.
Yeah, typically, yeah.
Okay. That's, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I suppose if you happen to kill him next to a house, you've mm-hmm. got somebody close to talk to. Yeah, I should say that statement is, I think, from Norwegian law, which is describing that the basic. I don't know if there's a three houses rule in the Icelandic law or not, but the basic principle is there. I mean, I think that particular quote is, I think, from Gulathing Code, which I think is, if I remember correctly, one of the Norwegian codes that were sort of mined in the process of creating. Am I wrong?
Yeah.
In creating the Icelandic. But same basic principle. Yep.
I had a question. In section 5, you say that if some changes in the law produce net benefits, it would eventually be possible for those who supported such a change to outbid its opponents by a considerable number of the votes and legislate change.
Right.
My question is that there's. In order for the market to work in this way, aren't there certain presuppositions which are likely not true, particularly would this system be subject to capture by someone who's like particularly wealthy or particularly powerful, so that the market for rights doesn't function very well?
The issue of concentration of wealth and power is a real issue. And I think the answer is that in the first couple of centuries, no single individual, there were individuals, of course, who were more powerful than others, but no single individual or small coalition really had the bulk of the power in Iceland. You're talking about a pre-dispersed system. And the system finally starts breaking down in the 12th. Well, there's an earlier incident in which coalitions form, which between them each add up to a sizable fraction of the power. But that ends up with people seeing that violent conflict is going to be very dangerous and agreeing on an arbitrated settlement. But the problem really arises starting around 1200-ish. The system is set up in 930, so that's about 270 years into it. By which time you've gotten this considerably greater concentration of ownership, in particular ownership of the lord of the right to be Gothi. And I don't think anybody has a really convincing proof of why this happened. And one possible explanation is the fall of the Christianity, because there wasn't really a tax revenue source in the original system. The only thing that was thought of as a tax was the contributions that members of Jörgen made who didn't go to the all-thing to the expenses of those who did go to the all-thing tax. But once you had Christianity, you had tithes. The priests were in effect under the control of local landowners who had donated the land for the church. And thus you had a potential revenue source which could be used to try to build up political power. And I think that's one possible explanation. An entirely different explanation is that it's the corrupting effect of alien ideology, namely the ideology of kingship, that if you came to a system where people thought what we're fighting about right now is not you did such and such to him and you owe him a fine you aren't willing to pay, but rather when the dust clears who's going to rule Iceland, that gives an incentive to try to form larger and larger coalitions in order to win. But I don't think anybody has a clear answer. But I think it is pretty clear that over a long period of time, you have at least some concentration of wealth increasing over society. And I think Bayok, in one of his books, talks about, I think a lot of the term, I think it was big farmers, was being used to be somebody who was a relatively important person.
So could concentrations of wealth be a problem in this
system? Oh, clearly. I think sufficient concentrations of wealth can destabilize. That's wealth really broadly defined, but the ability to exert force, really.
How does the modern anarchist solve this problem?
By observing that in some environments the anarchist system will be stable, and in some environments it won't be stable. It's not as if markets have an automatic tendency to concentrate wealth. There's this sort of myth that in a market society, firms get bigger and bigger. It isn't true. What's going on is that big firms are more visible than small firms. And therefore, at any given time, you say, what are the big firms? Aha, in that industry, there's a big firm. Well, there wasn't 30 years ago. Look, firms are getting bigger. But then you don't notice that the steel industry, when Carnegie formed U.S. Steel, it was, what, 40% of the steel industry? At this point, no steel firm, I would guess, is as much as 10%. So there's a biased viewpoint on it. Now, if it turns out, if you think about an anarchist society, if it turns out that the firms that are selling the services government now provides, the central ones, basically, protection of rights, if it turns out there are large economies of scale, such that a firm that's very large can outcompete one that's small, the situation is likely to be unstable because you end up with three firms and they say, aha, robbery is more profitable than honest business, let's recreate the government with us as it. If you end up with 500 firms, on the other hand, that's very unlikely to happen. It seems to me that Iceland, for the first 200 years or so, looks like a 500 firm world, and then in the Sturlung period, it's getting down more towards the other.
Does the anarchist consider the possibility of such instability a problem?
Yeah, I certainly do. It's one of the things I discuss when I talk about whether or not an anarchist society would work. And in fact, I think it's something I discussed in my first book, which was published 37 years ago, which was partly on that, and it's certainly something I've discussed since. In fact, I think one of the talks that I've got recording of webbed on my webpage is one in which I'm discussing, among other several other things, what reasons you might or might not get instability in that book. That would be a long talk, but if you're interested, I can probably point you at the relevant thing, because part of the question is why you would have economies of scale or wouldn't, and that turns out to depend on some other interesting issues.
I had a question. In the beginning, you talked about how studying the legal institutions of Iceland is interesting because they're so well documented. Yep. The literary output was similar to that of Athens. But then at the end, when you talk about problems that some people have pointed out with looking at the Tsars, they're mostly written after the violent breakdown of society. They might be projecting things into the
Tsars.
Are they really well documented?
Except that there's this long dispute about when the sagas were created. But at the most pessimistic view, they were created by people who had at least lived under the Icelandic, under the old system, under the Icelandic Commonwealth in the 13th century, and presumably knew a good deal about that you have, after all, the Sturluga sagas, which are describing the 13th century period. You can see that doesn't look very much like the family sagas, which are describing roughly the 10th and early 11th century period, and the size of the conflict is much larger in Sturluga saga. I don't think I discussed it in that article, but I don't think it had been done yet. But there's a fascinating piece of work by Jesse Bayok, who's one of the leading American scholars on this, was a colleague of mine when I was at UCLA long ago, and helped me with various things. And his is evidence from the medical literature
to show that the sagas were composed not long after the events. And it ended up as a Scientific American article that one of the best-known sagas, Egilsaga, one of my favorites, involves three generations of the family. Gveldulf, his son Skallagrim, and his son Egil. And all three of them are described as strange people in various ways. They're big, they're ugly, they're bald. And Egil in particular, who's the central figure, we know a bunch of other stuff about him. We know that he would tend to have his hands and feet cold. We know that he went blind early in old age. We also know what his skull looked like, because at some point after his death, they were moving a graveyard for some reason. And he'd been a famous guy, and so they dug up his skeleton and take a look at his skull. And it's strange, it's very thick, and it's ridged like a scallop shell. It turns out that there is a hereditary disease called Paget syndrome, first discovered in the 19th century, which fits all of these facts. That Paget syndrome results in continued growth on the outside of bones. Some percentage of people have it indeed have skulls that are ridged. It tends to result in blindness and so forth. So Biot's argument is that if the Egil saga was composed in the 13th century, several centuries after Egil's death, Egil would have died, I suppose, probably before 1000 AD, because his father was one of the early colonists, so would have colonized. In fact, yeah, probably earlier than that, because the colonization starts in 870, so probably Egil would have died in the first half of the 900s. That if the saga had been composed 300 years later and just used oral traditions of various things, it's very unlikely that all those facts would have stuck together. Whereas if it was composed a little bit after they dug up his skull as a oral literature, then the people who were telling it would have known all these things. You know, Egil was their neighbor, my father's neighbor, and would all go together. So Biot's argument was that this medical evidence supported the idea that the sagas were actually composed a little bit after the events happened. And the strongest argument against that, in my view, is that the sagas are prose, not verse. And it's much easier to maintain verse in an oral tradition than it is to maintain prose in an oral tradition, because the verse has got self-demonic characteristics, one of the functions of verse. But nonetheless, it's an argument scholars have been having, I think, for well over a century. People have been in Iceland about whether or not they are. But at the worst, they were composed by people who had lived under the end of the system, so to speak, and at least knew a reasonable amount about the earlier period. And I should say, there's other evidence. For example, Harald's saga, which is about Harald Hardrada, who arguably is the reason for the success of the Norman conquest of England. People know about Harald Hardrada? I don't know. There were two invasions of England in 1066. The first failed, the second succeeded. The fact the second succeeded was in part due to the fact that the English army had marched all the way up to northern England, fought a fierce battle, and marched back down again, and then faced William the Conqueror's invasion. That battle was with an invasion led by Hardrada, the King of Norway, who was a very able general, but not a very nice man. And there's a saga. There's a saga history of all the kings of Norway, but part of it is the Harald saga. And Harald spends part of his career as a Byzantine general. All right, that sort of sounds odd if we're not used to what the 11th century was like. But there was a sizable mercenary contingent that was an important part of the Byzantine military, which was at the time largely Norse, the Varangian Guard. And Harald's brother was the king of Norway, half-brother, was overthrown by a rebellion of his subjects, and Harald fought as a teenager, I think, in that battle, and escaped, and then fled to Constantinople. Joined the Varangian Guard, rises to become, I think, the commander of the Varangian Guard, eventually goes home again to Norway, and succeeds in becoming king of Norway. And the result is that Harald Klaga has information about what was happening in Byzantium in the 11th century, and it fits reasonably well with the Byzantine historians. So we've got some confirmation there. And there are other places where information in some of the sagas can be checked against external sources, and again, it seems to do pretty well. It's not like I'm an expert on Icelandic history, except by the standards of law professors, But my impression is that there is at least reason to believe that however it happened, a good deal of the information in the saga is accurate.
So, kind of transaction cost argument. You say that the poor can sell off their rights or their incentive or
their claims.
Their claims against somebody else.
Yes.
So therefore, justice is likely to emerge even when the weak are preyed upon by the strong.
Yes.
But if there are transaction costs in the system, doesn't that strongly suggest that it's going to be cheaper to kill off the weak if you're strong because they're not going
to... But it doesn't matter whether it's cheaper to kill off the weak. It only matters whether it's cheap enough so it pays to do it. The point is, in any system, there are going to be some people whose rights it's more expensive to violate than other people. In our system, you would prefer not to violate the rights of somebody who can afford a good lawyer. You would also prefer not to violate the rights of somebody who will make a sympathetic plaintiff to a jury. So it's not like any system really gives equal justice. I mean, that's an ideal. It's not an achievable objective. And the critical point here is that there is a mechanism by which somebody who cannot himself prosecute his case can nonetheless get it prosecuted. There is such a mechanism in our system, but it's not as good a one, in my opinion. Because in our system, if you're a tort victim and can't afford a lawyer, you might be able to find a law firm that will take the case on a contingency basis. But you have no way of knowing which law firm will do the best job for you. You're not an expert in the law. So therefore, you have no way of knowing which law firm you ought to make a deal with, how large a share they ought to get, or whatever. If we were not more than 1,000 years behind the cutting edge of legal technology, that tort claim would be marketable. And so the poor victim of a tort wouldn't have to guess which law firm would do the best job. All he wants to know is which law firm offers me the highest price. All right. So in that system, it's a superior way of doing the same thing we're doing. And it also has other virtues. I mean, this is sort of a digression, except that what's relevant in a sense to this class is that one of the reasons this course exists is that I concluded when this was my first venture into making sense of a weird legal system, that some of their ideas were actually ideas we could profit by. That there were respects in which they were cleverer than we are, just as there were respects in which the Athenians were cleverer than we are. And, for example, they made marketable tort claims also provide, I think, a superior way of handling the class action problem. The class action problem, as I hope all of you know, is that it is almost always in the interest of the lawyer to betray his clients, because the clients aren't really there. All right. Suppose I find plausible evidence that some wealthy firm has done something imposing a $50 cost on each of a million people. And so I get three of those people to agree to be representative members of the class. I persuade a judge to certify the case, and I now sue for $50 million on behalf of my three clients and all others so situated, all of you. And guess what happens? What happens is that we end up with a settlement. I get justice is done. The firm agrees to pay $30 million. And this $30 million consists of $10 million to me to reimburse me for my legal efforts. And a $20 million in discounts they offer to future customers who might or might not be the same people they have injured as the rest of the compensation. And I, as the lawyer, am perfectly happy to accept that. After all, it doesn't matter to me whether my clients actually get anything or not, and I've gotten my share. The firm would rather deal that way than actually pay the damages. So, you know, everybody's happy except the million people who I claim to represent. So, if you think about it, it's hard. The system really depends on trusting the judge who's somehow managing the case to be a competent, disinterested, benevolent manager who will make sure that the lawyer whose interest is not consistent with the interest of his customers does what he's supposed to do. Unlike the normal case, where, A, if you try to cheat your customers, your clients, they may get mad at you. And even if they don't, other people will be reluctant to hire you in the future. Well, in this, your customers are imaginary. There are a million people who've never heard of you. So I've got a better solution. And my better solution is have marketable tort claims. Allow those million people to sell not just this claim, they don't understand this when they sell it, but to sell all of their claims for less than $100. Some category of claims which represents the kind of claims that might be worth pursuing by a class action but are never worth pursuing yourself. And they sell those. You can imagine lots of mechanisms. When you buy your auto insurance, the insurance company says, look, we'll give you $20 off if you agree to transfer, or each year, if you agree to transfer these things to us. Or anyone who's already dealing with you, because these are not going to be very large sums, probably, because you're talking about, you know, small probabilities of not very large payments, but a lot of small probabilities. There are lots of different things you might be able to. Now, once you've got 30 firms out there who among them own 200 million bundles of claims, now the enterprising lawyer gets his evidence that some one of those claims is real, and he goes to those firms and says, I'd like to buy not your whole claim. I just want you to step right and sell me the claims for mercury poisoning, whatever the particular thing is. At this point, he is suing for 200 million people whose claims he's actually bought. They've gotten reimbursed ex ante when they originally sold their claim for an uncertain amount, of course. And it's in his interest to squeeze as much money as possible out of the defendant, thus giving the greatest incentive not to do things that end up you're losing lawsuits because he's the one who's possible. So I would argue that in that respect, the institution of transferable tort claims would in fact be an improvement in several respects on the way we now do things. And the only good argument I've seen against it is that people would say, wait a minute, the tort system is already broken. It's too easy to get unjust verdicts against deep pocket defendants, and you're only making it easier. Maybe that's true, but it strikes me that if the only defense for the rule is that it makes it harder to get results in a system where we don't want to get results because the rest of our rules are wrong, that's not much of a recommendation of our present legal system. All right. Other? Yeah.
I was just wondering, reducing rights to such economic terms,
yep.
Does that affect how the possible explanation for a legal system? So, would this system work under divine rights notion?
I think it's going to depend on what the divine rights are. If you take the Jewish case, actually, they make the distinction pretty sharply, because that's the distinction between Mammon and Esau. That Mammon, Esau is religious obligations. And the argument is that with regard to those, you have an obligation to God, and nobody can contract that away because God's not willing to sign the contract. But Mammon is obligations to other people. And part of the defense of the idea of giving the communal authorities the right to make law with regard to Mammon, even though they weren't religious scholars and weren't deducing it from Torah, was the argument that they sort of represented a kind of social contract, and that as long as you were dealing with things people were entitled to contract away, therefore they could contract them away. So if you think that, I don't remember what the details were in that, but that was a case where at least one such legal system explicitly distinguished between those rights that were only between people, which in principle could be contracted, and those rights that were obligations to God.
Sure. So was there anything like the latter in the Icelandic system?
That's an interesting question because something I've already discussed in the article. But the first big conflict in Iceland is a religious conflict. That Iceland is pagan, and in the late 10th century, Christianity is spreading through the Scandinavian lands, and one after another, the Scandinavian kingdoms are going Christian. And by near the end of the century, Norway is trying to pressure the Icelanders to become Christians, and some Icelanders have converted. And there's a certain amount of violence between the very enthusiastic Christian minority and the somewhat less enthusiastic pagan majority. And in the year 1000, this builds up to the point that at the Althing, the two sides declare themselves out of law with each other. Which is sort of a neat concept, because I think what they're saying is we are now two non-geographical countries with separate legal systems. However, cooler heads prevail, and the sides agree that instead of doing that, they're going to back off on that step. What they are going to do is to agree that the law speaker, who would happen to be a pagan, will be the arbitrator, and they will accept his arbitrator decision. And the story is he goes and puts a cloak over himself and lies there thinking for 3 days, I think. And when he comes up with a compromise in which Christianity will be the official religion, private pagan worship will be legal, but public pagan worship will not be legal. And I think there may have been a few other details. So presumably at that point, public pagan worship would somehow count
as an offense that wasn't against any particular person. So I guess it would be I have no idea. I don't remember it ever showing up in the saga's actual cases coming out of that. So I don't know how it would have been resolved. So I guess in principle, it could have been. And in general, the Icelanders had a somewhat iffy attitude to the religion. That there's a wonderful quote somewhere where one of the bishops is trying to insist that the law has to be such and such for religious grounds, and because the Pope says so. And one of the leading Icelanders, one of the Godar, I think, says, you know, I don't see why the opinion of some priest at Rome should take precedence over the wisdom of our ancestors. You ended up with a system where the church was very largely dominated by secular people for a long time.
Sure. I think, you know, and it's obvious, I'm not speaking specifically about Christian religion,
yep.
but it seems like in our own legal system, there are things which are considered beyond the reach of contract, or at least handed down by some authority that is not economic.
Yes, that in our system, I would have said that very loosely that's the criminal tort, that's part of the criminal tort distinction, so to speak. It's somewhat fuzzy that presumably, if you and I agree to have a boxing match, we aren't guilty of assault, even though we've done exactly the same things that otherwise would have been assault. Assault is criminal, not it's criminal as well as that we're not guilty of criminal assault. So you have rather limited abilities to contract away. My favorite example is sort of the limits of the argument of economic efficiency, which is based on a short story, but we'll now change the details. Is imagine you've got a very wealthy big game hunter, and he has concluded that the only game dangerous enough to really be exciting to hunt is man. And so he makes a deal. He finds 10 adventurers, and the deal is he will pay each of them $100,000. In exchange, they agree that he can pick one of the 10 at random and attempt to kill him. Now, of course, the guy isn't going to agree to let you kill him. That wouldn't be very exciting. But he agrees to give you permission to kill it if you can. And from an economic standpoint, it looks like an obviously efficient transaction that ex ante, the adventurer is willing to pay that, to accept the price, the other is willing to pay the price, and yet there's a gut-level feeling that somehow he should still be guilty of murder after that. This is based on a short story, which is not contractual, but in which you've got the wealthy big game hunter, how he gets the adventurer on his island, and of course the adventurer kills the big game hunter at the end of the story.
Is how he gets in there.
Is it?
Yeah, the most dangerous game.
The most dangerous game is the story. Yeah, you bet it then. Anyway, that's what I was inspired by. But it's an interesting test, sort of, to what extent you're willing to accept the implications of the straightforward economic efficiency kind of model. Yeah.
So I refresh my memory of.
Or straightforward libertarian model, of course, because, you know, sort of libertarian principles, you would say if you're willing to make the deal. Yeah.
So I had read in the Isle of Thought a long time ago, and I refreshed my memory by looking up the plot synopsis. And one thing I was impressed by the enormous level of violence and the inability of the part of the society to stop it once it gets started, and the ability of the various actors to egg on and keep things going when it seemed like, you know, under a system, a legal system I'm more familiar with, the violence would have come to an end pretty quickly when the relevant parties said there's really no further point to this.
You are aware that the real story of the most famous feud in American history is that it did come to an end fairly quickly and was revived by, if I remember correctly, the governor of either West Virginia or Kentucky.
Yeah, you were mentioning this,
that's the case just the other way. But the problem with that intuition from the sagas, which lots of people get, is that you're not bothering to check dates. That my wife's standard example, I think it's from the Njál saga, is that there's a chapter in which there's some violence and someone is killed. There's another chapter in which there's some violence and someone is killed, and then you notice that one of the people who participates in the second chapter is an adult, hasn't been born in the first chapter. So that they're telescoping. That they're leaving out the boring bits
right.
when nothing is happening,
children,
and then focusing. Yeah, that is in the Njál saga, the feud is going through a fairly long period of time, and certainly, you know, as feuds go, it was a protracted one, which is why it makes it one reason why it's a famous saga. But as far as one can tell, if you actually look at the sagas, especially if you compare them to what else is happening in the world at the same time, it's a pretty peaceful society. That that we don't have really good murder rate data going back in history, but such data as we have suggest that murder rates, say, in the 14th and 15th century in England, were much higher than in modern society.
Well, Pinker's new book, At the End of Violence, talks about that. Murder rates in the earliest times. The data we have is like 30 per 100,000
well,
per year.
That's first, you've got the argument about primitive people. That's Keeley's book, Warfare Before Civilization. And Keeley argues pretty convincingly that hunter-gatherers are really murderous folk. That the reason we don't see it that way is their population is so tiny. So we say, well, look, the two tribes clashed and only six people were killed. Yeah, but there were only 100 people in the fight. 6% of casualties in one clash is a lot. And furthermore, Keeley says, those battles that we think of as very ritualized, that isn't where the real work is being done. The real work is being done when the warriors from one tribe sneak up on the village of the other tribe and massacre all the men and steal the women. But in any case, but going back, I haven't read that book, but the data I've seen for England, at least, suggests that murder rates, I think it was 14th to 15th century, in some one place where they had data, were something like 10 times as high as the 18th century rates. And it's not clear if the 18th century rates were higher than the 19th century, and I'm not sure if the 19th century were higher than the current. That gets complicated.
No, but all, it's a pretty steady decline. At least that's what Pinker's data claims.
Maybe. The data that I looked at when I was doing my 18th century English stuff, the rate of homicide indictments in the 18th century is similar to the rate of homicides known to the police in the 19th century. Now, you don't know if those are comparable statistics or not. So I'm not sure that it's that simple. And the U.S., 20 years ago, had a pretty high murder rate, I think, even by U.S. standards. It was up to about 10 per 100,000, about 1 per 10,000. But in any case, my basic point is that you want to think about the Icelandic in comparison with other 10th or 11th century societies. And the way I like to put it, which I can't prove, but I think is probably true, is if you look at the breakdown period of the Icelandic system, which is the Sturlunga period, that Iceland in 50 years of intermittent civil war probably lost fewer people, a smaller percentage of their population, than England, Norway, and Normandy lost in 3 weeks of the year 1066, that being the two big battles. And I've also got some other data, which I don't have in there because I didn't have it then, and that's the conversion. Because Iceland had two religious conflicts. The second one was Catholic versus Lutheran. And at the pagan versus Christian conflict, kills, I think, about 6 or 10 people total before it's settled. The forced conversion to Lutheranism when Iceland was under the rule of one of the Scandinavian monarchs, I'm not sure it was still Norway at that point, kills about 60 people. And the population was smaller in the second period than the first period. So that's at least a little, you know, all of these are scraps of data. But that's a little bit of evidence suggesting that the Icelandic system handled conflict better, not worse, than what we would think of as a conventional royal system. There's a piece by the guy who wrote Guns, Germs, and Steel,
Diamond,
I'm forgetting his name, which is sort of an attack on the Icelandic system and implicitly a criticism of arguments that I and people like me make. But it's got some interesting information, but it's really a pretty dishonest piece. And among other things, he gives as evidence of the failure of the system a piratical attack in Iceland, which happens, I think, about 200 years after Iceland has become part of the King of Norway. The interesting part of it, which I didn't know, is that he argues that what's happening in Iceland is that the Icelandic ecology is considerably more fragile than Norwegian ecology, and the settlers don't know it. And that the result is that they're doing pretty well in the early period, but they're cutting down trees which aren't going to grow back, and in various other ways, in effect, living on their ecological capital. And that explains why in a later period Iceland gets
poor. I think he covers that more in decline, because I think decline covers the collapse.
But he also has an article which purports to be a book review of three books, one of them by Bayok about Iceland, but in fact, in various places, says the opposite of what the authors of the books say and doesn't mention the fact. So I found it sort of irritating at the time. But also, one of the inconsistencies is he argued, he thinks that the decentralized legal political system reflects the poverty of Iceland. But that's the system that was set up at the beginning, which is when, by his account, it wasn't poor. So anyway, there are lots of problems. That lowered my opinion of Diamond. I read part of Guns, Germs, and Steel and thought, at least as far as I got, it was a neat book and I ought to finish it someday. But this one made me feel somewhat differently. And the one thing that irritated me about Guns, Germs, and Steel, I should say, is that he first criticizes the idea that some groups are genetically superior to others, and then argues that the Papua New Guineans are genetically superior to us due to having been in a harsher environment with more selective fresh earth. There seems a certain inconsistency in that position. Anyway, so other things you want to talk about. I've got a long list of stuff I can talk about, but I'm perfectly happy to talk about whatever interests you in this, which is probably a more productive activity. Yep.
Just simply because Richard Posner is someone we all read a few of, I was wondering if you could, if he made any responses to the critique you did of his theory or anything like that.
That is the critique in Law's Order. The answer is that he has a very nice blurb on the back of Law's Order. So no, I don't think. I think he's probably over time somewhat weakened his claim. And I think I eventually, which claim? That is, his big claim, of course, is the efficiency of the common law. And Law's Order is in part an extended examination of that claim with evidence for and against. But the particular question of private enforcement, if that's what you're thinking of, I believe I eventually persuaded Landis and Posner that their assertion that the private system would over-enforce was false. That was simply an artifact of their simplifying assumption. That if you're interested enough, my article on efficient institutions for the private enforcement of law is also on my webpage, and it's a somewhat technical article. But what's going on there is that they are simplifying their model by assuming that punishment consists of a costlessly collected fine up to some maximum and no possible punishment beyond it. And it turns out that with that simplification, if the circumstances lead to over-enforcement in the private enforcement system, you have what's called an internal solution, meaning, in this case, that the best you can do is a fine below the maximum fine. And if they lead to under-enforcement, you end up with a corner solution, meaning that you run into the barrier of maximum fine, you then charge the maximum fine. And they say, aha, so except in the case of corner solutions, you have over-enforcement. And, I mean, it's sort of, most of you aren't mathematicians, so the corner solution is the case where something happens because of the boundary. So let me take a very simple example, because you may or may not remember. Suppose we have a function.
Pens that actually work.
What?
Suppose we have pens that actually work.
There's a function. And at the maximum of the function, the slope will be zero.
All right.
Standard basic calculation. But suppose that the function goes like that, and it doesn't exist above zero. At the maximum, the slope is not zero. Hence, that's a corner solution. Hence, you can have a theorem saying for a continuous function, the slope is zero except for corner solutions. So in that kind of case, it's legitimate to say that except for corner solutions is a special case. But this is one where the only reason there's a corner solution is that instead of assuming that you can ramp up the punishment with less and less efficient punishments, unlike fines, they set it as an all or nothing case, and one of the two alternatives ends up running into the all or nothing barrier. That's no reason to expect one that is more likely than the other. And I'm pretty sure I convinced Landis of that, and I think I convinced Posner, who's not. Posner is not a very good economist. He's a very smart guy, and he knows a whole lot about the law, but he doesn't have good economic intuition, which is why his good work is done with people like Landis, who is a competent economist. Back before I had my book, I used his for teaching law and econ, and I think at one point I sent him a list of comments, many of them critical, which were about a tenth as many pages as the book I was criticizing. And I'm sure some of them he accepted, some of them he didn't. But I'm pretty sure that I got the claim that private enforcement led to over-enforcement out of the later edition of his book. I think that's right. The sort of background, I mean, sort of coming in the middle, it's not all of this is really in that article, but that
Becker and Stigler, who were two very prominent, very good economists, very able economists, had written this neat article on the compensation of enforcers, in which they argued that the standard model of police was not incentive compatible in economic jargon, because the value to the cop of to the criminal of not being caught is typically much larger than the value to the cop of catching him. Therefore, the criminal has an incentive to bribe the cop. Therefore, you need more cops watching those cops, and that's a clumsy institutional design. And aha, if we pay the cop with the fine that the criminal pays, the problem goes away. That was their starting idea. It's sort of a neat idea, and that raises a bunch of questions. One of which is, we say the cop, but in this case, the cop is really a bounty hunter. All right, so can anybody bounty hunt? Am I going to worry that after I've spent a lot of time getting the goods on you, he'll haul you in because he's done it first? So how are we going to define property rights to who gets to hunt down the criminals, so to speak? Well, one possible way of doing it is to say the victim owns the property right. He can then transfer it to anybody who wants it. We've just reinvented tort law. Because that is tort law, right? So I don't think that occurred to Becker and Stigler. I can ask Becker. Stigler's not alive anymore at the time they wrote the article. But in any case, Landis and Posner then have this rebuttal, as it were, in which they say, well, maybe this is a good idea, but we can prove, rigorously prove, that that system cannot be as efficient as a perfectly run state enforcement system. You know, we don't claim we've got a perfectly run, but at least that's a weakness. And that proof was a neat proof. Because the proof is, imagine a system where you have firms in the business of buying claims from victims, catching criminals, convicting the criminals, and then getting paid by the fines the criminals pay. And in that system, when the legal system sets the fine, it's setting two things. It's setting the punishment to the criminal if he's convicted, and the reward to the enforcer. But the reward to the enforcer is going to determine how hard the enforcer tries to catch criminals. Hence, the reward to the enforcer will determine the probability that a criminal will get caught and convicted. In principle, for any particular offense, there is some optimal combination of probability and punishment that at the lowest cost deters that offense. And again, if you look through Law's Order, I go through that in some detail. If you have one control variable, namely the fine, to adjust two different things, the punishment and the probability, only by chance will you get both of them to their optimal values. So that's their proof. It's a neat proof. It's wrong. But it's wrong only in the sense that what I showed in my article was, if you change the rules of the game a little bit, you could set it up so that the firm's profit-maximizing decision automatically optimize one of the two variables, and you're only left with one to do. And that, you can read the article, I don't think it's worth going through it in that much detail here. But if you look at my article on efficient institutions for private enforcement, at least if you're comfortable with levels of math that are not horrendously high, but are high by law school standards at least, I think I prove that if instead of setting the punishment, we set the expected punishment. We say, if you buy 100 claims and bring in all the criminals, you can only fine them $100 each. If you bring them half of them in, you can fine them $200 each. If you bring in a tenth of them, you can fine them $1,000 each. That then it turns out that the costs that go into determining the optimal punishment probability pair all end up as costs to the enforcement agency. It wants to minimize them, and therefore it picks the optimum punishment probability pair. That's the very, very short version of something which takes more time than I'm going to spend on it here to explain. But anyway, so it was important to me, because it was that interaction that got me into law and econ. That basically I was doing other forms of economics when this controversy came up between Becker and Stigler and Landis and Posner. I wrote two journal articles for the Journal of Legal Studies, one of which was what I just described, a purely theoretical article, which I think, among other things, explained the Landis and Posner argument better than they had explained it, and probably better than they understood it. But they had the argument. It's just the first time you come with something, you don't always come up with it in the most elegant fashion. And I think I could reduce it to a cleaner version, but then showed why, in one sense, it was wrong. Why it was correct for the institutions they assumed, but could be solved by changing the institutions. Which, however, raises other problems. I'm not claiming that the issue is over, but just the
And then the other one was the Icelandic article, this article that you've now read, which came into existence. Because I said, wait a minute, haven't I heard about a society who did that? Where when you killed people, they sued you. And, you know, I had a long-standing avocational interest in the Middle Ages, so I think I must have read, you know, one or more sagas at some point. So I then set out to learn everything I could about the legal system of saga period Iceland, given that I didn't read Icelandic, and the one surviving law code at the time had not been translated into English. It was translated much later. However, parts of it had been translated into German, and I read some German, though not fluently. But the sagas were all in English, so that was sort of the main primary source. So that's how that article came into existence. And I submitted the articles to the Journal of Legal Studies, which at that point was, I think, edited by Landis, and got an invitation to come to Chicago as an Olin Fellow for a year to do work with them. And they published the articles. I think I already told you about the notes on the theoretical article where the notes in the margin referred by the referee referred to the Landis Posner article as "we," which I thought was amusing. So I knew who my referee had been. So anyways, that's how I got into in-law and econ, which has been lots of fun. Anyway, other points that occurred to you? Yes.
What exactly do you mean by pure form of institution? Pure form of institution.
Where do I use the term?
Use it more than one time on page 2.
Yeah, I don't remember. I wrote this article, whatever, 30 years ago or something, 20 or 30 years ago. But presume is the context to make the point that whereas our system is a mix of tort and criminal, theirs is using one system for doing everything.
Well, first you said medieval Iceland, however, presents institutions of private enforcement of law in a pure form.
Yes, right. Sense that if you think about the context of modern societies, there is quite a lot of private enforcement. But our tort system is privately enforced, and the job of getting the evidence and persuading the court is private. But then the enforcement of the verdict is public. Whereas in the Icelandic case, the whole process is private because of the feudal system. And similarly, we have various bounty systems. If you go back to, you know, wanted $100 dead or alive, that was one where a private person was doing the job of the policeman, but he was being paid at least some of the time by the state that set up the bounty. So in that sense, a system where prosecution and enforcement are all done by private actors in their own self-interest, as it were, is a pure form of something which exists in less pure forms in lots and lots of legal systems. So I think that's what I meant at the time. I say, you know, I wrote this a long time ago, so it's not like I can give you a verbatim account of why I used every word, but I should say one of the problems that I think Landis and Posner didn't appreciate is that if you really run through their argument, it not only proves you can't have efficient private criminal law, it also shows you can't have efficient tort law, because think about their argument applied to torts, and they would claim, well, torts, you normally know who did it, so the issue of finding the guy doesn't arise, but the issue of convicting him still arises. And the higher the damage payment for a tort, the greater the incentive for the plaintiff to try to win the case. So therefore, you in principle, if you sort of could analyze the tort system, you'd say, well, there is some optimal expenditure on litigating the case, because greater expenditure presumably gives you a higher probability of getting the right verdict, but it's costly, so there's some trade-off between expenditure and accuracy of verdict. There is some optimal damage payment for the offense, and we would like a legal system against both of them. But when we set the damage for something, we're simultaneously determining both of them. So precisely the Landis Posner article for why tort law isn't efficient for crimes, it also shows it's not efficient for torts. So I don't know if they have ever got a response to that point, but I think I did make it at various points. All right, so other things. Roughly, yeah, I don't remember how much detail I go into on the details of the history in the article, but basically, let me sort of run through the very brief chronology and description of the sources for this. Iceland is discovered by the Norse about 870 AD. There is some reason to think that the Irish may have known about it earlier, and some evidence that there were some Irish monks there, though probably not very many earlier. It's settled between 870 and about 1000 or 930, somewhere around that time. And at least according to the Icelanders, the reason for the settlement is an earlier Harald. This time is Harald Haarfagr, not Harald Hardrada. Hardrada, by the way, means of harsh counsel. It's hard reed. If reed is an old English word also for counsel or advice. And going back to the second Harald, the one who invaded England in 1066 and lost, he fought a long war with the king of Denmark. And Harald won every battle. He was a much better general. And he never got to hold any land as a result, any extra land as a result, because nobody in his right mind would trust Harald, whereas the king of Denmark was apparently a very nice guy who people relied on and trusted. There's actually one of the short sagas that partly hinges on some of that stuff. But the earlier Harald unifies Norway. That basically the traditional story is that he was king of one of a group of small kingdoms in what's now Norway. And he wanted to marry a princess in one of the other kingdoms. And her reply was that Harald was too small a king for her. And so Harald swore that he would neither cut nor comb his hair until he had made himself king of all Norway. And he set out on a career of conquest and succeeded. That actually intersects the beginning of Egil's saga because Egil's grandfather has some unfriendly interactions with Harald and ends up leaving Norway, and in the process killing a couple of Harald's kinsmen to pay him back for killing one of his sons, because even kings pay where geld, though they may not have it so. So Harald unifies Norway, and the Icelandic version is that Iceland was probably settled as a result. That basically Norwegians, who didn't like the new regime, which not only was unified but was a stronger monarchy than the small monarchies had been, what were the main professions of Norwegians at the time? They were farming and piracy. They were Vikings, and so they loaded up their longships with their family, relatives, workers and as much of the farm stock as could fit, and headed off for Iceland, which had just been discovered. They settle Iceland. They eventually decide they need a legal system. Well, they're Norwegians. The Norwegian system looks pretty good, except there's just one bug in the Norwegian system. So they decide to have the Norwegian system minus the king. And that's how, at least the Icelanders' account of how you end up with this odd kind of decentralized system coming up back in the 10th century. So the legal system is set up in 930. They sort of agree on a formal system, which I sketch in the article with the chieftains and all the rest of it. It various minor changes through about 1000 when the Christian-pagan dispute happens. That gets settled by arbitration. The first point at which the law is written down is, I think, in the early 12th century. At some point in, I think, the 11th century, if I remember correctly, it's been a while, there is a feud that develops in which the two coalitions expand to the point where each of them is like half or a third of the people relevant to coalitions in Norway. I mean, in Iceland. And it looks worrisome. And the two sides come to the Althing sort of armed for bear, ready to fight each other, and cooler heads prevail, and they agree on arbitration, and the whole thing settles down. And then about 1200, you start having increasing levels of conflict. You start having coalitions which control a whole bunch of the Gothar in a particular, of the Gothords in a particular area. And you have a sort of a shifting civil war, which is looking more and more as though the objective is to be the guy running Iceland rather than just to satisfy your legal claims. The king of Norway is meddling in this. That's another explanation of what's happening, that Norway has come out of a period of a lot of internal conflict, and you now have a relatively strong and wealthy Norwegian monarchy, and the Norwegian monarchy is using mostly money, not weapons, to try to interfere in Icelandic politics to subsidize one side or another. Basically, if your side loses, you flee to Norway, swear to be the man of the king of Norway, and he gives you money to go try to come back and revive your side. Once you succeed in reviving your side, you decide you're not the man of the king of Norway after all, and you're going to run things for yourself, and now he supports the other guy. So,
So it went on that way for a while. Finally, in 1262, three of the four quarters of Iceland vote to accept the rule of the King of Norway. In 1263, the North Quarter, which was always a little bit different from everybody else, votes similarly, and that's the end of the old Icelandic system. And the sources of information, the main source of information that I'm using are what are called the family sagas. And these are the sagas, which are basically historical novels, something between histories and historical novels, really, which are describing the events through a little after 1000, through the early 11th century. And they're quite readable. I mean, I recommend if you want some light reading. Hegel is my favorite, but Njalssaga is very good, and Laxdala Saga is good, and so forth. And they tend to be very realistic and understated. If you compare it to some of the medieval European literature, you don't have heroes who kill hundreds or thousands of enemies the way you do in the chansons de geste, the French heroic stuff, or the Arthurian things. That basically a really top flight hero brags that he once fought 10 men and survived the experience. That sort of is the scale. And most of the fighting is very small scale. Might or might not have you. Most of the fighting you're seeing in the sagas is, you know, four guys on this side and six guys on that side kind of scale fighting. It's not what we would think of as warfare until the Sturluva sagas, which you're describing in a much later period, where you get much, much larger fighting. And the events of this, they are about the 10th and early 11th century. They're written down in the 13th and 14th centuries. Maybe the only known author, the person who wrote the saga history of the kings of Isle of Norway and who may have written Egil's saga, is Snorri Sturluson, and the Sturlung sagas are called that because the Sturlungs were one of the major families fighting the civil war, and Snorri was in fact a participant, an active one of the leading figures in that conflict, but he was also an author. And so we then have these arguments where there is evidence at least that things in the sagas check against evidence from other sources of what was happening at the same time. So there's some reason to trust them. How much we don't really know. The structure of the system I've already described, and we've already talked about how feud systems work, and this is sort of my original example of a feud system. And you can compare it to the gypsy systems that one wonders if perhaps the conversion from an oral to a written version of it made it less flexible and maybe helped lead to breakdown. We don't know. But at least that's one of the differences. Initially, like the gypsy law, it's oral, but eventually they write it down. One of the sort of neat features of the oral system is that part of the job of the losobomafer, the law speaker, who's the only real employee, part-time employee in the system, is to memorize the law code and recite a third of it each year at the Althing. He's got a 3-year term. And if he leaves something out and nobody objects, it's out. So I like to describe this as an early version of sunset legislation. All right, I think we're out of time on this. We can talk more next time, but at least. Tuesday instead of Monday, correct. Thank you for reminding me of that.